If all of them, Trump said from the start he'd leave them as is. Paul Ryan, an otherwise passionate champion of entitlement reform, first said that without entitlement reform, he couldn't bring the budget into balance and pay for Trump's defense spending spree. Later, Ryan appeared to give Trump a pass because, frankly, that's become Ryan's only option. Instead of accepting Trump's Sherman-esque statement on entitlement reform, Ryan did a backflip worthy of a Bulgarian gymnast by claiming entitlement reform would affect, quote, people near retirement age. Ryan has consistently been right about the need to fix these programs, but he keeps missing the emotional problem with cutting even a dime from Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. They are wired deeply into the American culture of soft socialism, and the GOP never truly had an appetite to fix them, despite the Tea Party's endless bloviating on the subject. Despite Ryan's desires, Trump read the hypocrisy of the GOP base like the experienced con man he is. He knows his support skews older, poorer, and whiter, particularly in the red state target markets where esoteric Trumpism was greeted with whoops that would shake the mold off a trailer's walls. These social programs, and increasingly the disability program of Social Security, aren't considered big government. They're an economic mainstay. A much-mocked trope from the peak of the Tea Party era occurred at a town hall meeting held by Republican Representative Robert Inglis of South Carolina. A man stood up and angrily demanded of Inglis, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." Now take that moment and inject it with a massive bolus of meth, OxyContin, resentment, and simmering white working class anger, and Donald Trump was never, ever going to go there. Decades of fell warnings of the entitlement program doom that was coming to us are now in the memory hole. Paul Ryan can't even broach his favorite topic of entitlement reform in 2018, given midterm elections are coming and most of America views the GOP with the same warmth and regard as they do genital warts. Whoever replaces Ryan as Speaker won't do it in 2020 because Donald Trump will be running for re-election. The fiscal time bombs of Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are still ticking. Trump will likely be dead of a KFC-induced heart attack before we face up to them. Coal is Trump for Solyndra. Donald Trump's economic nostalgia is a powerful force, both for him and for his followers. Nothing, though, seems to ring his Proustian bell for the industrial era like coal. Ah, coal. The shittiest, most miserable, most polluting, most dangerous energy source in our portfolio. The industry had been dying a deserved, slow death at the hands of natural gas and solar, until Donald Trump decided to revive it with a suite of executive orders and the leadership of Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency. Barack Obama's early plans to encourage a green energy sector in the U.S. included loan guarantees for companies like the solar energy vaporware firm Solyndra. When Solyndra was granted a $535 million loan guarantee in March 2009, Republicans lost their minds in anger. The phrase, picking winners and losers, was one of the GOP's central talking points in opposition to Obama's stimulus and its emphasis on green energy. Representative Paul Ryan didn't like it much then and made it clear on Fox News Sunday after Solyndra met its inevitable demise. Ryan said, "There are billions more of this exact kind of spending that came out of the stimulus that will produce these results we fear. This is industrial policy and crony capitalism at its worst. It's Exhibit A for how this kind of economic policy doesn't work. We shouldn't be picking winners and losers in Washington. We should be setting the conditions for economic growth so that the private sector can create jobs. Washington is not good at picking winners and losers, so we shouldn't try." Trump consigliere and walking time machine Steve Bannon once said of his plans, "I'm the guy pushing a trillion-dollar infrastructure plan. With negative interest rates throughout the world, it's the greatest opportunity to rebuild everything. Shipyards, ironworks, get them all jacked up. We're just going to throw it up against the wall and see if it sticks. This will be as exciting as the 1930s, greater than the Reagan Revolution. Conservatives plus populists in an economic nationalist movement." Coal? Ironworks? Why not America's long-lost buggy whip industry? Isn't it time we revived our vital town crier market sector as well? Trump's own tactics attempting to shame companies who threatened to outsource jobs played out both on the campaign trail and in the early days of his presidency, and reflect Trump's authoritarian streak as the national bully. These were American companies competing in a global marketplace. Trump's threats to punish them with the power of his tweets, his bully pulpit, and his government sent a shock through the corporate world. Trump's early experiments with trying to browbeat private companies into submission were like chapters out of the Junior Authoritarian's Activity Guide. Ford, Carrier, GM, and Boeing were early examples of Trump's attempting to use his Twitter pulpit. He scared firms into announcements that they would be bringing back jobs from overseas or canceling foreign manufacturing deals in order to placate Mad King Don's online rages. He tweeted, "General Motors is sending Mexican-made model of Chevy Cruze to U.S. car dealers, tax-free across border. Make in USA or pay big border tax." Less government. But is that weed I smell? The nation made up its mind on marijuana a long, long time ago. We're okay with it. Personally, I haven't smoked it since 1985, but you do you. In what represents almost a perfect test case of conservative hypocrisy in the age of Trump, suddenly the great and terrible powers of the federal government have been activated in Drug War 9.0. For all the blathering by conservatives about respecting the states, adhering to the 10th Amendment, and fighting for individual choices and freedom, the Trump Party looked at the ballot initiatives and laws passed in the states to reform the draconian sentencing and possession guidelines for marijuana and said, "Whoa there! The devil's weed must be stopped," in the righteous tones of a southern tent preacher. Massive majorities in both major political parties favor legalizing medical marijuana and the decriminalization of possession. Majorities favor the legalization of marijuana for personal use. In states that have decriminalized and legalized, regulated, tax-paying markets have emerged, providing jobs and revenue to the states, and stopped the prison pipeline, where, primarily, young black men have languished for possession for as little as 1 ounce of marijuana. In the event you've been living under a rock, the war on drugs has failed spectacularly. All wars on drugs fail spectacularly. Republicans used to believe this. Libertarian Republicans used to hold this as a central article of faith. No longer. Trump's payback to anti-drug hardliner Sheldon Adelson played directly into the skill set of Jeff Sessions, a Republican senator turned attorney general turned scourge of the 420 crowd. Sessions saw the states exercising their power to manage their own affairs, set their own sentences, and decide what recreational chemicals their citizens could consume after a long day, and turn the DOJ into a wrecking ball. Reversing an Obama-era policy of minimal federal regulation of state marijuana laws, Reefer Madness Sessions went to work destroying a multi-billion-dollar sector in the emerging economy. When Obama's administration used Operation Choke Point to cut off access to banking, credit card processing, and other financial services to thousands of legal, licensed firearms dealers, many Republicans, myself most certainly included, went apoplectic at the vast federal overreach. Sessions has turned exactly those same tools on the marijuana industry, with only muttering from the GOP in return. Individual choices? The 10th Amendment? Getting Washington out of the business of the states? Not in the age of Trump. Live by the EO, die by the EO. The problem with unlimited government is that it keeps getting bigger, metastasizing into more and more forms that its creators never envisioned. Departments and their missions creep over wider and wider swaths of American life, expanding into territory their creators never intended. Many Republicans looking for ways to justify their embrace of Trump fall back on one particular node of reasoning I find completely insufficient. Claiming that Trump is using executive orders and regulations to get things done. They keep insisting that Trump's governance by executive order and by policy changes is a true accomplishment for conservatism. They're wrong, of course, both in substance and in the procedural nature of how a conservative can and should govern. By their own words from just a few years ago, Obama was a lawless tyrant for using executive orders. The headlines from the conservative press were breathless and hyperbolic. Executive order tyranny. Obama plans to rule America with pen, phone. Obama's chief of staff admits they want tyranny. Three ways Obama's executive orders are the worst of any president. Obama the tyrant, a presidential overreach that undermines the most important foundation of the Western political tradition. I was no fan of it myself, but if governing by executive order was wrong when Obama did it, why not when Trump does it? Is it just one more hypocritical knot in this skein of excuses Republicans will make for Trump? The likely explanation is the paucity of other accomplishments. Executive orders and regulatory tweaking are almost all they've got to show for a president who kills most of the legislation he touches. Executive orders are by their very nature ephemeral, intangible, and easily subject to the whim and whimsy of the next president, be they Democrat or Republican. When executive orders are reversed, as Trump reversed many of Obama's, we end up reposing more and more power in the hands of the executive branch. It gives Congress less and less motivation to act. Executive orders and bureaucratic tweaking have almost no impact compared to the passage of a law. Will you get every single thing you might like in a sweeping executive order compared to a messy legislative fight? No, of course not. I know it's old-fashioned, but it takes us back to the pesky intent of the founders, as always. They envisioned this kind of problem and built the dynamics of compromise into our Constitution and our system of government precisely because they knew competing states and districts would have competing interests and ideals. They understood that Congress would be responsive to different cues than the executive. The goal was to pass laws and govern, and not merely by executive fiat. There are areas where executive orders are appropriate, necessary, and beneficial. Day-to-day governance is not one of those areas. Conservatives taking victory laps over Trump's reversal of rules on coal, oil drilling, climate change, abortion, and other issues important to the cause are overlooking the fact that they haven't truly achieved anything more than a momentary victory. They've given future Democratic presidents the justification not only to undo what Trump has done, but to impose new executive orders of their own and continue to diminish the role of Congress in setting the laws that govern this nation. Inside the Oval Office, Act 5. You look around your office one last time. The Uniform Division Secret Service officer is standing behind you. There's not much to take, really. A small, framed photo of you and POTUS, the president grinning and shooting the thumbs up. Your phone. A handkerchief Ivanka had dropped coquettishly near your door. The copy of The 879th Turning, an examination of history and power through the story of locusts that Steve Bannon had given you. You realize you're a microcosm of the entire administration. You had no business being here. And once you were, you didn't know what your real job was from one moment to the next. You'd been surrounded by people who were similarly in the dark about their real missions and about who had power and authority in the process. No one was loyal to anyone else in the building. It wasn't a team of rivals. It was a raw, Hobbesian nest of vipers. Like everyone else, you'd bought into the image of Trump as a decisive leader. But after so many months up close, you discovered he was anything but. This moment of self-awareness stretches for a long, long time, until the officer politely clears his throat. As you walk down the White House drive, you think about home and how you'll tell your family the president fired you. Then you realize it. Being fired by this president may have been the best thing that could have come out of this experience. You head for a bar near the White House. It's on the edge of the George Washington University campus, about a block away. It's dim and quiet. There's a gorgeous woman at the bar, sipping a tequila. It's the First Lady. Her detail is nearby, but they recognize you. She beckons you over and smiles. You croak out, "He fired me. And God help me, I'm happy." "Don't worry," she whispers. "The Donald divorces everyone in the end. In the meantime, tequila. It's good. Be best." Chapter 9. The Grown-Ups All Die Too. By April 2018, Donald Trump's administration had lost more cabinet members and senior staff than any administration in the past 150 years. Even the mature, experienced people who came to serve the president with the best of intentions left with their dignity strip-mined away by Trump's circus act. Reputations and political futures have been shattered. Decades of good deeds and honorable service have been stained. The burn rate of the moral, intellectual, and political capital of the people who joined Team Trump is spectacular by any standard. The terrible tragedy of John Kelly. After the departure of the hapless, luckless Reince Priebus at the end of July 2017, the White House needed a break. The chaos field around Trump was intense, and the news hits coming against his presidency made it seem as if the White House was lurching from one crisis to the next. In the brief interregnum between naming a new chief of staff, America watched the antics of Anthony Scaramucci, a man with the affect of a person deeply familiar with the edgy joys of Bolivian marching powder. Scaramucci's rise as the court jester of the Trump White House soon came to a screeching halt. The warring factions inside Trump world that had pushed Reince off the cliff needed a steady hand. They needed a grown-up. They needed adult supervision. They needed John Francis Kelly. Kelly, a 45-year Marine Corps veteran, had served honorably and well, rising through the Corps with a reputation as a man who got things done. In the long-running war on terror, he also made a sacrifice few in the highest reaches of government do in this age. His son, First Lieutenant Robert Michael Kelly, USMC, died in combat in Sangin, Afghanistan in 2010. In Kelly, each faction thought they'd be getting something they needed. For the Bannonites, Stephen Miller and their ilk, Kelly would be an administrative accelerator for their plans to purge America of the brown people. For Jared and Ivanka, it was a way to discipline Daddy and keep their sinecures intact. For Team Crony and the Goldman guys, it was a moment to relish. Finally, a strong professional who could tamp down Trump's worst impulses, end the tweeting, and focus the White House on what mattered, their tax cut plan. A nervous Washington expected Kelly would finally discipline Trump, cut off the flood of crazy articles thrown on his desk, and end the tweeting. General John Kelly is a man out of central casting for the job of White House turnaround executive. He was already vetted and was serving as Secretary of Homeland Security when he was named Chief of Staff. He was perfect on paper, a disciplined, accomplished military leader with deep experience in managing complex, multivariate problems and organizations. Kelly is bluff and straight-talking. Finally, the grown-up that Trumper Room needed to settle the boisterous children down for a nap. Kelly has qualities Trump himself lacks. Discipline, focus, and diplomacy. Like every other military general who pins on that fourth star, Kelly had been through the military's charm school, and he can work with discretion and determination. He would also begin to lose all those characteristics the moment he took the job as chief of staff. He had some wins on the front end. If there was a polar opposite to John Kelly for seriousness, it was the aforementioned hyper-caffeinated White House leprechaun Anthony Scaramucci. Within hours of Scaramucci's announcing he reported directly to the president, didn't have to work through the chief of staff, Kelly dropped the hammer on the mooch. Trump gave Kelly the latitude to do it, and D.C. saw the firing of Scaramucci from his role as White House communications director as a good thing. After a twilight struggle with Steve Bannon, Kelly sent Bannon off to spend more time with his gout. In a reality TV show moment worthy of an Emmy, Kelly fired Trump's longtime sister-from-another-mother reality TV frenemy, Omarosa Manigault. Omarosa had been identified as one of the people around Trump who would stoke his already lavish sense of entitlement, his rampant paranoia, and his juvenile desire to scrap with people. Lachlan Marquet and Aswin Subsang of The Daily Beast called her patient zero for unfettered access to the boss. She played Trump's ego, vanity, and rages like a fiddle, and Kelly needed the exact opposite. On the day she was dragged from the White House grounds, it was said she tried without success to enter the residence. It's remarkable she's still alive. Someday the video will leak. Omarosa, honey, the cameras were rolling, but they're not the ones you're used to on The Apprentice and Big Brother. It went downhill from there. By the spring of 2018, Kelly's transformation as an effective counter to Trump's impulsivity and indiscipline had fallen apart. Like the rest of the White House and the rest of America, he was just along for the ride. Kelly might make the paper flow move smoothly, but he can't stop the president from digging himself into deeper political and legal holes and from giving the perverse imp on his shoulder free rein. After the death of U.S. Army Sergeant LeDavid Johnson, a Green Beret killed on a mission in Nigeria, the president called his grieving widow. It didn't go well. Trump is alleged to have told her that Johnson, quote, knew what he signed up for, and the president struggled to remember her husband's name. Their conversation took place in the presence of Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, an African-American Democrat from Florida who backed up the wife's account. A few days later, Kelly tried to challenge Wilson's account by claiming Frederica Wilson had lied and exaggerated at an event he'd attended during his tenure with the U.S. Southern Command. It turned out Kelly's account was itself a lie. It wasn't a good look. Then, Kelly raised eyebrows in October 2017 when he wandered into the swamp of defending Robert E. Lee's honor. In a White House that had nearly been destroyed by its long flirtation with the alt-right and its disastrous handling of the racist hate march organized by white supremacist and Nazi fanboy Richard Spencer, after Charlottesville, Kelly might have been a wee more mindful when it comes to celebrating Confederate generals. Kelly had originally been placed in the Department of Homeland Security because he was perceived to have two things Trump loves, a military background and a hardline position on immigration. Kelly was there during the notoriously botched rollout of Trump's Muslim ban and had been a stalwart defender of the ban and of the rest of Trump's vocal anti-immigrant rhetoric. It should have been a tell that some of the values our military holds dear today, inclusion, teamwork, and the sense that America really is an ideal and not just a race, got lost somewhere along the way in the belly of the Trump beast. Days before what would become a defining moment in the progression of Kelly's terminal death from ETTD, he stepped into a verbal bear trap. When asked if the president would extend the deadline for deporting the American-raised children of illegal immigrants covered under the DACA program, he responded, "There are 690,000 official DACA recipients, and the president sent over what amounts to be 2.5 times that number, to 1.8 million. The difference between 690 and 1.8 were the people that some would say were too afraid to sign up, others would say they were too lazy to get off their asses, but they didn't sign up." Too afraid or too lazy was a sign Kelly was growing quite comfortable with the Trump White House's style of racial dog whistling. DACA is an issue the rational few in the White House understood as a double-edged sword. On the one hand, the Make America White Again demo at the heart of Trump's base wants everyone with a vowel at the end of their surname deported on the next train down Mexico Way. On the other, they understand how utterly catastrophic the policies of ripping apart law-abiding immigrant families looks. As D.C. struggled to resolve DACA, Trump's chief of staff's gaffe tore another hole in Kelly's position as an honest broker. For all Kelly's missteps and failure to rein in Trump's behavior, it was Rob Porter who permanently broke John Kelly's reputation. The story of Rob Porter would be unexceptional in most cases, but Kelly's handling of it shows in many ways just how deeply compromised he'd become by spending time in the moral vacuum of Trump's personal orbit. Porter was serving in one of those faceless, anonymous, utterly vital White House jobs you've never heard of, staff secretary and personal assistant to the president. The person holding this job has some of the most frequent and intimate contacts with the president and chief of staff. It was Porter's role to help John Kelly keep the paper flowing to the president, and by all accounts, this was a rising star in Trump world. There was just one problem. Porter's ex-wives and friends told the FBI he'd been physically violent and emotionally abusive in the course of their relationships. Porter, a man handling some of the most sensitive and consequential documents placed before the president, was unable to be cleared by the FBI for a top-secret SCI clearance the job required. Hell, with a reputation like that, Porter wouldn't pass the background check at a Waffle House. This was a widespread problem in the Trump White House, given that many of the people willing to work there were either dragged away from a bus station with promises of a fifth of old Ocelot bourbon and a hot meal, or were the problem child sort of D.C. fourth stringers. The problem for Kelly wasn't simply that he defended Porter even after the revelations were made public. It was that Kelly knew Porter's difficulties in getting a clearance 6 months earlier. White House counsel Don McGahn was also aware of Porter's background as an alleged domestic abuser for more than a year by the time the story broke. Kelly made it worse by initially issuing a ringing defense of Porter's character, partly engineered by Porter's then-girlfriend, Hope Hicks, who took over as the White House communications director after Scaramucci was booted. "Rob Porter is a man of true integrity and honor," Kelly vouched, "and I can't say enough good things about him. He's a friend, a confidant, and a trusted professional. I'm proud to serve alongside him." Kelly was forced to issue an awkward backfill statement to try to undo the mess he'd created for himself. Days later, Kelly was forced to dismiss another White House staffer for domestic abuse. In a period when the Me Too movement was reviving a frankly moribund class of political feminism, Kelly's actions would have hurt any chief of staff. Hovering over Kelly's failures in judgment, however, was President Pussy Grabber's reputation as a serial and self-admitted sexual harasser. From the now ubiquitous adult film actress and object of Trump's temporary affection, Stormy Daniels, to a cast of 19 women who came forward to tell their stories of Trump's sexual misconduct, harassment, and sleaze, Trump's attitude toward women is a matter of public infamy. Even though Trump was later reported to have said Porter was sick, he continued to defend his former aide as Kelly twisted in the wind. Trump's views toward women clearly infected his White House at some level, John Kelly included. Everything Trump touches dies, and in this White House, John Kelly's reputation and honor were no exception. Watching Kelly's stature dissolve in the acidic slurry of amorality, stupidity, and moral blindness of the Trump White House was a slow-motion tragedy that made his former military comrades shake their heads and made Washington ask itself a painful question. If this guy can't get him under control, who or what can? Rex Tillerson's Year in Hell. Rex Tillerson was a letter-perfect pick for a Trump Secretary of State. The wealthy corporate titan is the former CEO of Exxon, Russia-philic, tall, and equipped with a sweeping head of silver hair. He looks the part, which is important for shallow Don, and he's the big-swinging-dick corporate type Trump only dreams of being. While Tillerson hadn't been his first choice, a number of people close to Tillerson put his name on Trump's radar screen as the president was trying to decide between Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, and Shakes the Clown. His first reaction to the Exxon CEO bordered on gushing enthusiasm combined with his usual reality TV salesmanship. Trump jumped in as Tillerson's hype man, teasing Tillerson's name for secretary, and from December 2016 to February 2017, it was all sunshine and praise. Reading these tweets a year and a half later and knowing how far Tillerson would fall is redolent with irony. Trump tweeted, "Whether I choose him or not for state, Rex Tillerson, the chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil, is a world-class player and dealmaker. Stay tuned." And, "I've chosen one of the truly great business leaders of the world, Rex Tillerson, chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil, to be Secretary of State. The thing I like best about Rex Tillerson is that he has vast experience at dealing successfully with all types of foreign governments." Finally, "Congratulations to Rex Tillerson on being sworn in as our new Secretary of State. He will be a star." Trump's coming hatred of Tillerson should have been obvious from the start. Tillerson's decades of international business experience involved more than licensing skyscraper projects and cheap ties. He knew people abroad and where many of the levers of power were located, particularly in the Middle East and Russia. While Donald Trump was hustling real estate branding deals, crappy steaks, and a strip mall university, Rex Tillerson was running the largest public corporation in the world. While Donald Trump was eyeballing beauty pageant contests in their dressing rooms, Rex Tillerson was expanding Exxon's global reach as the world's energy giant. Tillerson was confirmed with a sigh of relief from Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. He was one of the axis of adults, a man who spoke their language and who wasn't one of the outliers or edge cases inside the already restive White House. His marching orders at the State Department represented some of the worst instincts of the nationalist populist mafia at the White House and Trump's own vast overestimation of his ability to negotiate with foreign leaders and powers. The long-running cliché of the State Department as a branch of government on its own, impervious to reform and to reorganization, wasn't far from the truth, but its unique, vital, oddball set of needs and roles in the world meant that no president of either party burned it to the ground. The arsonist cadre around Trump had other ideas. The soft power of the State Department represented a role for America in the world they simply can't abide. Multipolar, internationalist, global in reach and perspective. The neo-isolationist build the wall and stop the brown people crowd around Miller, Gorka, Bannon et al. Viewed state as an enemy of their vision of an America with a smaller footprint around the globe. Also, Hillary Clinton had been Secretary of State under Obama, so the only rational solution was to nuke Foggy Bottom from orbit. Tillerson's first actions were to ensure his frenemies at the White House would let him get on with the work at hand, so the firings in Foggy Bottom began. It was, as the New York Times reported, a parade of dismissals and early retirements that decimated the State Department's senior ranks. As happened in other departments under other secretaries, Tillerson either never had the authority to fill states' politically appointed positions or lacked the inclination to do so. Applying all the dumbest management cliches from the corporate sector, Tillerson clearly had been told that shredding the institution was the order of the day, and he got to work doing just that. One former diplomat wrote, "Tillerson has canceled the incoming class of Foreign Service officers. This is as if the Navy told all its incoming Naval Academy officers they weren't needed. Senior officers have been unceremoniously pushed out. Many saw the writing on the wall and just retired, and many others are now awaiting buyout offers." He has dismissed state's equivalent of an officer reserve, retired Foreign Service officers, who are often called upon to fill state's many short-term staffing gaps, have been sent home despite no one to replace them. Office managers are now told three people must depart before they can make one hire. No matter how much Tillerson was initially willing to endure of Trump's erratic nature, pissy sniping, and the chaos in the administration, by the summer of 2017, the honeymoon was over. Tensions arising from Trump's shoot-from-the-lip style, and particularly his hideous showboating at the National Scout Jamboree, put Rex on edge. It was a July 20th, 2017 meeting that led Tillerson to finally snap and commit a Kinsley gaffe, which is Washingtonese for a verbal misstep that states an undeniable truth. One of the most secure rooms in the country is located in the Pentagon. It's called the Tank, and it's a conference room of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It's less imposing than you might think, unless they've remodeled it since my days at the Pentagon. It looks pretty much like a standard government conference room. On that July night, it was crowded with Trump, Bannon, Priebus, Prince Jared, and senior military leaders desperate to get Trump to focus for 5 minutes on trivial things like America's national security challenges in a changing world. This attempt rapidly went off the rails. As Trump and his senior staff were briefed on America's defense and nuclear posture, Trump insisted on a tenfold increase in our nuclear arsenal. This, of course, would be globally destabilizing, abrogate a number of treaty obligations, and require somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 trillion, which, even by Washington standards, is real money. At the end of this train wreck of a meeting, and presumably once Trump had left the room, his military leaders sat slack-jawed and stunned, and Rex Tillerson said what was on all their minds. "The president is a fucking moron." Well, duh. Tillerson's star fell at that point, though even Trump wasn't stupid enough to lose three cabinet officials at once. Tillerson, for a time, was part of the famed Mattis-Tillerson-Mnuchin suicide squad, wherein a tacit agreement reportedly existed to quit en masse if one of them was to be fired in some fit of Trumpian caprice. With Vice President Mike Pence in as conciliator, Trump and Tillerson papered over their differences for a time. But as with all things Trump, his simmering, juvenile resentments and obsessions meant Tillerson would be sidelined over and over again. The breaking point came in March 2018. Trump had been rooked by the crafty North Korean despot Kim Jong-un into a face-to-face summit meeting, a goal that the DPRK's government had been desperate to achieve for decades. It would elevate Kim, solidify his power inside the Hermit Kingdom, and defer further American military action. It was a consequential decision by Trump to agree to the terms of the wee Korean dictator, but agree he did. He did not, however, inform his Secretary of State. The tension was so thick you could cut it with a knife. But Tillerson soldiered on until, during an official visit to Africa, he made a fateful error. It had to do, you'll be shocked to learn, with Russia. On March 4, 2018, a former Russian GRU officer named Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia Skripal were poisoned by a rare Russian nerve agent. Skripal had spied for the British, been caught and imprisoned by Russia, then was traded in a spy swap years later. He'd been living a quiet life in Salisbury, about 90 miles from London. Vladimir Putin, being Vladimir Putin and feeling empowered by a U.S. president clearly willing to let him run amok, decided to whack Skripal. This did not sit well with the Brits, and Secretary of State Tillerson spoke out in support of our oldest and most important international ally. Tillerson said, "We have full confidence in the UK's investigation and its assessment that Russia was likely responsible for the nerve agent attack that took place in Salisbury last week. There is never a justification for this type of attack. the attempted murder of a private citizen on the soil of a sovereign nation, and we are outraged that Russia appears to have again engaged in such behavior. From Ukraine to Syria, and now the UK, Russia continues to be an irresponsible force of instability in the world, acting with open disregard for the sovereignty of other states and the lives of their citizens. We agree that those responsible, both those who committed the crime and those who ordered it, must face appropriate, serious consequences. We stand in solidarity with our allies in the United Kingdom and will continue to coordinate closely our responses. When you hear it, it has the cadences, signifiers, and seriousness of the Secretary of State of a serious nation talking about a serious issue. It's not a tweet, a Breitbart headline, or some professional wrestling kayfabe. It was Tillerson's last official act. To most people with a pulse, it was pretty obvious the Home Office in Moscow had called with some management critiques of Tillerson shortly after his support for the Brits, because Trump fired him within hours of the statement's release. Contrary to the White House's assertion, Tillerson had not been fired days before, but instead learned of it from President Passive Aggressive's tweet. The connection between a clear-cut critique of Russia in defense of an ally and Tillerson's firing did not go unnoticed. His transformation from the CEO of Exxon to a victim of Donald Trump's foot-stomping outrages and bizarre defenses of Putin and Russia in the space of a little over a year must have left Tillerson disoriented. Whatever his other characteristics may have been, he was a serious person in an administration staffed to the walls with clowns, jokers, borderline personalities, and Trump-like man-children. You don't run Exxon for over a decade without a suite of interpersonal management and decision-making skills. But in the end, those skills were insufficient to protect Rex Tillerson from the curse of Trump. Tillerson's departure came during a week of extraordinary chaos, even by Trump standards, but served as a very clear warning shot for other professionals considering service in the Trump White House or the administration. If a man like Tillerson could be humiliated, his good name disparaged, his reputation wrecked, and be booted out the door with a tweet, what could lesser mortals expect? Mattis, save us. The coalition of adults around Trump is small, fragile, and not nearly in control enough. As of May of 2018, Jim Mattis is the only one who still matters. Presidents traditionally name strong cabinet members, appoint competent people to execute their agendas out in the agencies, and select ambassadors to be the face of the United States abroad. Trump essentially rounded up people from behind the bus station and hoped for the best. With a handful of exceptions, Jim Mattis being at the top of the list, Trump has named the weakest, most ineffective cabinet in generations. At the time of this writing, he's been going through this cabinet like an industrial wood chipper, firing and moving the deck chairs on the Trump-tanic with abandon. The singular pillar of sanity, competence, stability, and integrity in the Trump administration is Jim Mattis. As Secretary of Defense, Mattis is the unique anchor in Trump's world who seems immune from firing, humiliation, and Trump's tantrums. For the good of the nation, let's hope it stays that way. Joel Serby, Bill Kristol, and I secretly met with Mattis in the spring of 2016, making a last, desperate bid to find someone, anyone, with the stones and the record to leap into the presidential race, pull an Eisenhower, and save the country from Trump. Why Mattis? Why would we chase a former general who had no incentive at all to suffer the slings and arrows of a short-term independent presidential run? Because if you went into a lab and said, build me a clone army of kick-ass American warriors, they'd fire up the CRISPR and build Jim Mattis. His service, his character, his intellect, and his no-bullshit affect seemed like the perfect remedy for a time when we were facing a test of America's faith in itself every day. It was a last-ditch play, but it made sense. A profound faith in mediating institutions helped bind the American dream, but in dozens of polls and focus groups, nearly every American institution, both parties and their leaders, banks, the business world, organized religion, academia, and beyond, is distrusted by the American people. One institution, however, remains at the very top of public ratings of trust and confidence, the military. In the political world, Eisenhower wasn't the inevitable or expected choice for 1952, but his positioning against both Robert Taft and Adlai Stevenson, based on the universal confidence in his military accomplishments and integrity, solidified his candidacy. In a restive post-war moment, Ike didn't want the job, but he accepted the mission because the country's future was at stake. Mattis didn't want to run for president, but to save the country, he took a role in the administration. Today, he represents the most vital stabilizing force in that administration, the de facto leader of American foreign and military policy outside the lanes of Trump's White House cadre. Trump leaves him to his own devices, and we should sleep more soundly for it. He's the single person in Trump's administration I hope the curse misses. Mattis has kept well clear of the White House vortex. Determined to face the challenges of Russia, Syria, ISIS, Iran, North Korea, and the rest of the portfolio of dangers with his usual marine frayeur. The physical comparisons couldn't be more glaring. Soft-bellied Donald Trump versus Mattis's lean, hangdog frame is a comparison of one man who spent a lifetime shoveling Kentucky Fried Chicken and Filet-O-Fish sandwiches down his maw, and one so abstemious he eats two meals a day and rises before dawn to put in 5 miles of road work. One man answered his nation's call for 4 decades of decorated service in the Marine Corps, and one spent his life fighting the Battle of Pussy Grabber Ridge. One man has read deeply in strategy, history, military affairs, economics, and the classics. The other can barely grunt out the words on his teleprompter and serves as America's least intellectually curious and least read president since Andrew Jackson. Note to Trump lovers, that's not a compliment. Part 3. Surrounded by Villains. The following transcript was provided by WikiLeaks in the fall of 2024. Intercept 1. Top secret. Sensitive information. Origin controlled. No foreign distribution. This transcript represents the collection of sensitive discussions among the senior military and civilian leadership of Russia. Audio quality is variable as it was collected using a drone-based directional recording system hovering over Mr. Putin's Black Sea dacha at Krasnodar Krai. Begin transcript. Machine and human translated. Spiritfire voice match 0.996 certainty. Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin.
Can't be real. You're fucking with me.
Spiritfire voice match 0.803 certainty. Igor Valentinovich Korobov, Director of Russian Main Intelligence Directorate, the GRU.
Vola, you won't fucking believe these guys, how easy it was.
Putin.
He really uses an insecure cell phone? All the time? Yabtovomat!
Translation note. Mr. Putin is using a common Russian expletive and not directing Korobov to fuck his own mother. Korobov, laughing.
Such luck. An old Android phone. A 17-year-old from Donetsk cracked it. We've been listening since before he was elected.
Putin. Play it again. Room sound. Audio begins. Operator.
Please hold for the president.
Trump.
Hey.
Hannity.
Sup.
Trump.
Blowing off homework.
Hannity.
That stupid summit. Just wing it. You can cheat off Z.
Trump.
Yeah, it's boring anyway, and Kelly keeps trying to make me read the president's daily brief. F that. That's my Fox and Friends time.
Hannity.
Damn right, Mr. President. The friendly friends at Fox and Friends have your back.
Trump.
So what's up with Tucker? I feel like he doesn't love me as much as you love me.
Hannity.
No one loves you as much as me, Mr. President, in a very straight way that would never bother Mike Pence at all.
Trump.
You know, there was only one time at Studio 54.
Hannity.
Sir?
Trump.
Never mind.
Hannity.
Sir, I'm going on the air in 30 seconds.
Trump.
I'm watching. I'm always watching.
Drone out of range. Transcript ends. Chapter 10. Welcome to Hell. The new Trump establishment and the legion of Trump fans hate one thing more than Hillary Clinton, more than Barack Hussein Obama, Nancy Pelosi, George Soros, or zombie Ted Kennedy. And that hatred burns with a passion hotter than a supernova. It's a hatred cleaner, sharper, and more immediate than they have for any real or imagined demon on the left. By now, unless you've been living in an underground bunker, you know the thing they hate beyond words and reason is conservatives who won't bow and take a knee before Trump. For them, The Never Trump movement represents history's greatest monsters. They hate us because we've done things and know things. Expertise is their kryptonite. They hate us because we stuck to our guns. They blame us for every loss and forget our roles in the 1,000 victories that led to Republican and conservative majorities in the House, Senate, and state legislatures. They project their treachery to the cause with our determination to preserve it. Their sweetest fantasy was that Trump's new establishment would overthrow and exile all the old establishment and purge the experts, the smart guys, and the operators from the hated ancient regime that tried to stop the Donald and save the Republic. Those of us who had served in prior administrations legitimately hoped for the best, feared the worst, and stocked up for Schadenfreude-palooza. We were amply rewarded for our preparations. The spectacular body count in the Trump White House includes firings, disgraces, dismissals, witchcraft trials, panicked flights from the building, and Trump PTSD victims with a dead-eyed stare that chills the soul. In all, 34% of the White House staff was gone in the first year, a number unprecedented in any country that isn't run by pirates, drug lords, or cannibal dictators. And yes, it gave us more than a bit of pleasure to say, "We told you so." From masters of the Trump universe to disgraced, unemployed, and unemployable laughingstock is a bad look on anyone. But the personnel meat grinder of this White House has those of us on the outside looking at them with a weapons-grade case of Schadenfreude. Revenge, being best served cold with a nice charcuterie platter and a good Barolo, is delicious. Let's indulge, shall we? Let's get the firings of people who were trouble for Trump out of the way first. These folks aren't technically victims of the Everything Trump Touches Dies curse, but in each case, they were a threat to his Trump-centric kleptocracy and his dreamed-of royal court of lackeys, lickspittles, jesters, spittoon holders, and minstrels. Every administration purges the most senior, most political types from the prior era. The president has every right to name a cabinet and appoint senior government officials. But because of the Trump team's flaming ineptitude and inexperience, their early wave of firings was handled with all the subtle delicacy of a monster truck show. Their purges were, as expected, politically moronic and legally dubious. Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey is the jewel in the stupid crown of his disastrous, tone-deaf, extra-legal approach to government. He didn't just fire his FBI director in a flagrant effort to obstruct justice. He bragged about it to both Lester Holt of NBC News and to, you might want to sit down for a moment, the Russian ambassador in a private meeting in the Oval Office. This decision would be the single most consequential moment in his early presidency, if only because it was so predictably going to lead to an epic political shit show, launch the Mueller investigation, and haunt his every waking hour. His choice to fire other officers, including Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, Ethics Advisor Walt Schaub, U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara, and FBI Director Andrew McCabe, created media and political martyrs, guaranteeing them a role in the constellation of critics who were liberated and vocal. Capo of the L'Affaire Russe MAGA crew Mike Flynn, a disgraced former Army general, was so outrageously in bed with the Russians that even Trump was forced to fire him. A predecessor to Flynn as the Defense Intelligence Agency director once told me the Russophilic anti-Muslim general was the most dangerous asshole ever to head a three-letter agency. The fastest route to being fired in the first 6 months of Trump's regime was to have any record of working in Washington with actual adults. They should have known better, but Reince Priebus, Katie Walsh, Mike Dubke, Sean Spicer, Rick Dearborn, and the other D.C. pros fell victim to Donald Trump's unmanaged and unmanageable personality. They didn't understand that Trump's character would render their experience moot, their efforts for naught, and their reputation in tatters. Congressman Tom Price, an affable backbencher from Georgia, was perfectly comfortable in Congress, but he made a critical mistake. Donald Trump liked him, and Price accepted the position of Secretary of Health and Human Services. Like so many of Trump's appointees, Price suddenly looked at the federal budget as his plaything, taking private jet flights instead of flying commercial. He was the first to be fired, but he wouldn't even be close to the last. It wasn't that Price was a particularly bad actor in the great scheme of things. It was that the environment of the Trump White House made that kind of behavior normal. EPA head Scott Pruitt demanded first class and private jet travel because, I kid you not, People said mean things about him on social media. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson was caught up in a scandal over a $31,000 dining room table for his office. It was all so tragic because it was all so petty. As of May 2018, Pruitt, Carson, and others, under the clouds of scandal that seem to darken the days of almost every Trump cabinet official, are still clinging to power. Down the chain. At the beginning of the Trump presidency, official Washington still held out hope that Trump would bring in a professional team and that he would listen to counsel, allow a strong chief of staff to fulfill that vital role, and tap into some well of discipline, focus, and resolve heretofore unseen. They convinced themselves that he would act and look and operate like a president, and that the majesty of the office would bring his staff along into that same dignified frame. That didn't quite work out. The misfit toys at the top and the clowns, rejects, human refuse, ne'er-do-wells, and wild-eyed ideological edge-case drifters who populate the administration prove the Emerson rule is always right. An institution is the lengthened shadow of one man. A's hire B's, and B's hire C's, and Trump hires people you could find sleeping on a subway grate or planning their basement abattoirs. Their greatest joy seems to come not from taking power in D.C. and executing the amorphous but passionate Trump agenda, but from attacking, insulting, and punishing those who did the actual work in the field for the conservative revolution. Nothing outrages this president or his minions more than the slightest resistance to his madcap urges and the stunningly terrible policy ideas that sprang from his fox-addled brain. In the long arc of American political history, a job in the White House, any White House, is considered one of the greatest career opportunities in the world. Serving the President of the United States is a singular honor and a privilege, a role for the best of the best. Those driven and skilled enough to sacrifice 4 years of their personal lives for the 24/7 job of a White House aide. If you are valuable to the President of the United States, corporate America is ready to snatch you up the moment you walk out those gates for the last time. A White House bump on one's resume has never been a bad thing, regardless of party, the politics of the day, or the success or failure of the administration. Not so in Trump's White House. These jobs are a curse, and just as his death touch affects everyone he encounters, its effects linger. In early March 2018, the White House was suffering from a wave of scandals, departures, setbacks, crop failures, and political own goals. Suddenly, many of the masters of the Trump universe were looking for jobs. You could hear the sound of the nanoscale violins of the reviled old guard and never Trump crowd as resumes started hitting email inboxes from Trump White House and administration staffers looking for a quick exit from the disaster area. Their desperation was palpable. "The longer I stay, the more likely it is that I'm going to get Mueller'd," said one when pitching a colleague of mine for a job. BuzzFeed reported that White House staffers were not necessarily getting the kinds of high-paying offers in the corporate world that former aides usually do. One White House aide said, "I've talked to several people in the last week trying to find a way out, but they can't get out because no one is really hiring people with Trump White House experience. Not a fun time, to say the least." Trump's island of misfit toys is chock full of people who possess only the barest competencies one would expect from a White House staff, including little things like professionalism, a sense of personal honor, the dignity and the understanding that the White House is not a palace for a king, and that 1600 Pennsylvania isn't a royal court. As policymakers go, none of them will likely leave a mark, because all policy emerges, and I hope you'll pardon the use of this legislative term of art, from Trump's ass. There was little to recommend them to start with, and nothing upon their exits. Those who left in scandal, and due to the purges run by Chief of Staff John Kelly, in some ways have a better story to tell than those who fled because the stress of working for our version of Mad King Ludwig broke their will to live. Those who leave soon discover there are only so many slots for contributors at Fox News. Washington's lobbying firms and think tanks are looking for people with abilities beyond bootlicking, knob polishing, and obsequious ass-kissing of the umber overlord. Those skills may be sine qua non in Trump world, but are, to put it mildly, less valuable elsewhere. Other Trump team skills, like dog-whistling the alt-right, stoking ethnic and racial tensions, and fighting for the return of 19th-century trade and industrial policies, are also in low demand on K Street, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and the civilized world. Some senior White House staffers will wander into the new ecosystem of Trump cheer squads, media outlets, and scam packs as long as the Donald is still around. Future administrations won't beat a path to their doors or consider them voices of counsel and consequence in the long run. No wise men will emerge from this debacle. It's the lower-level appointees who will suffer the longest. Even those who came on board for the good of the country in hopes of moderating and managing Trump's catalog of pathologies and obsessions. They're stained. They'll spend their lives explaining why they elected to serve a president destined for disgrace. And if that fails, a barista position at Starbucks or selling blood plasma are good options. Are you surprised they're about to be unemployed and unemployable? Don't be. Everything Trump touches dies. Rot from the bottom up. Donald Trump hasn't drained the swamp or changed Washington in part because the only people he could find to join his government are human train wrecks. Setting aside the clown show of the inner White House team, Trump's administration combines all the things you'd expect. Venality, incompetence, a stunning lack of policy knowledge, and a slurry of people dragged from Trump's business world who couldn't manage a Waffle House. Trump doesn't have staff. He has acolytes. He doesn't have experts. He has enthusiasts. In every administration, the true power of a president comes from staffing the government with his people. Every president picks appointees who represent his values and policies and who, to use a technical term, get shit done. Within weeks of Trump's inauguration, it was clear things weren't going well and never would. CNN reported the Trump administration still had over 1,900 vacancies in March of 2017. Even allies like National Review's John Fund wrote, "The administration needs to pick up the pace of hiring. If nothing is done, the problem will only get worse. At the current rate of nominating individuals to positions, we could see the Trump administration's first or even second anniversary before it would actually be filled with Trump people." In every prior modern administration, the thousands of jobs each government must fill were a matter of transition discussions long before Election Day. Leaders have allies, friends, subject matter experts, and policymakers they start talking to well before Election Day. Personnel, famously, is policy. Trump staffed his administration so slowly and so poorly that the federal bureaucracy couldn't believe their luck. Far from draining Washington's swampy bureaucratic precincts, the Trump administration, when they bothered to staff them at all, put in place appointees without the skills, experience, or judgment you might find in the staff of a particularly badly run Kmart in some small Midwestern town. The handful of Trump appointees who made it into appointed positions were soon made aware that making America great again would depend on Donald Trump shutting the hell up from time to time. They barely made it through the day, waiting for their impulsive commander-in-chief, the tweeter of the free world, to go off the rails. This president's skill isn't the art of the deal, but the art of setting his own ass on fire and causing the world around him to panic. Not every person in the Trump administration is a low-rent, mouth-breathing doofus who couldn't get hired at a car wash. Many serving in cabinet, sub-cabinet, and White House roles joined Team Trump in good faith, believing they could help steady the ship, smooth the rough edges, and just maybe put some conservative policy wins up on the board. All of them understood that President Trump's undisciplined style was risky, but hoped his distractions would give them cover to work steadily and quietly on the administration's legislative priorities. A few were of the Bannonite taint, with a history of overtly racist douchebaggery like Carl Higbee and Sam Clovis. Some of them even bought into the America First New Nationalism. Many quietly assured friends in Washington that Trump would settle into his job. After all, he did reassure Americans, "I can be the most presidential person ever." Uh-huh. They figured Trump would turn his political capital, social media power, and deal-making acumen into big, popular Republican legislative wins, and that his lack of interest in policy details would let them and their allies, former bosses and friends in Congress, set the agenda. Feeding Trump's ego came with the territory, but why not let him take a victory lap after every success? Then reality set in. The tax bill being the notable exception, 2017 and 2018 were legislative disasters, And the tax cut only survived because Ryan and McConnell kept Trump a million miles away from the process. The president botched TrumpCare 1.0 and contributed little as Speaker Paul Ryan managed to ram the public relations nightmare, TrumpCare 2.0, through the House at the cost of much political blood and treasure,